Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to Weavecast, and this is a bit of a special show. This is Weavecast's one-year anniversary. The past year has been a wild ride. There have been some ups, some downs, but most of all, there's been you. So thank you for listening. We've got a lot of fun things to celebrate. First, we're going to talk about some news, some great new blogs I've discovered, our Teach a Friend to Weave contest that we're going to be holding in March with prizes. Then we're going to discuss an exciting technique, woven shibori, with Catherine Ellis. We're going to review her book, and I'm going to talk about my experiences with woven shibori in our swatch of the day. And then we'll finish things up with a quick review of the past year of Weavecast, how things have gone, and where we might be going in the future. I've been reading some great weaving blogs recently. First, I'd like to mention Bonnie Tarsus's new blog, Weaving Spirit. That's at weavingspirit.blogspot.com. She was a guest on episode 9 of Weavecast, and she's posted some really beautiful work, and it's fun to hear her talk about her weaving process as she works on items in her studio. Next, I'd like to mention Curious Weaver, by Karen Madigan. She's an Australian weaver who does amazing work. I've been having a lot of fun reading back through her blog. Her blog is available at curiousweaver.id.au. And as always, the links for these blogs will be up on the show notes, so no need to go diving for pen and paper. In the intro, I mentioned that in March, we're going to be having a Teach a Friend to Weave contest. I thought it'd be a really great idea to have people invite their friends who don't have looms over to weave to make it even more tempting. The way to enter is any time starting from now to March 31st, find a friend who's interested in fiber, teach them something about weaving, give them that first weaving experience. Because we've heard from a lot of these wonderful weavers that I've interviewed that sometimes all it takes is sitting down for that first time at a loom and throwing that shuttle. And that can be all the inspiration somebody needs to spend a lifetime weaving. Give them that first experience. And then have your friend call the Weavecast voicemail. That's 1-206-734-4411. And all they need to do is mention their name, your name, and a brief sentence of what they learned to weave. Here's the kicker, though. If your teachee would like to talk more about their weaving experience, I would love to have some of their stories on the show. So I'm actually offering two different prizes. One prize will be for most students taught. The other prize will be for best story. So if you have an especially entertaining garrulous friend who's always wanted to learn to weave, I'd go be talking to them right now. 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk to the Whidbey Island Weavers Guild, and it was so much fun. And I think it went over well. The audience seemed to really enjoy the show, and I know I had a blast. What a talented and fun group of weavers there are on Whidbey Island. I also have to thank Robin Spady, who was my technical guru. The other treat that day was I got to drive over with Astrid Bear, who is a weaver at the Seaview Weavers Guild. She runs a really entertaining blog at fishwrapper.wordpress.com. And if you want to get her perspective on how my talk went, you can go to that site, which, of course, there will be a link on the show notes. The only thing that went wrong that day was after the talk, I asked the audience to give me a shout out to play on the show. So we did like a 1-2-3 countdown, and then a room full of 40 women said, "Hello, Weavecast!" and it was this wonderful wall of sound, and I just loved the moment. And a technical glitch prevented that from being recorded. Okay, I say technical glitch. What I really mean is I pushed the wrong button. Oh, it was heartbreaking. I am so sorry, guys. I remember there were people in the audience going, "We're going to be on the podcast." Well, I wish you were. I really, really do. But the good news is you can be on the podcast anytime you want. All you need to do is give me an audio comment, go up to the website and click on that audio button. Or if you don't have a computer microphone, you can call the Weavecast voicemail. And that number again is 1-206-734-4411. Speaking of the call-in and audio lines, we've gotten some great listener comments. First up is some thoughts about weaving inspiration from Laura Fry.
Hi, Sine. Recently, someone emailed me to ask how I keep motivated to weave. It seemed to me that she was looking for a reason to put a priority on getting to the loom, but life, as will happen, often got too busy for her, and her intention to weave got set aside, and that she needed some reason to put a higher priority on her weaving. There are many reasons for my being able to get to the loom, the wolf at the door being a prime one, since we do rely on my bringing in an income, and I choose to do that by weaving. I am the kind of person who is highly motivated by deadlines, so I tend to challenge myself by committing to have something done by a certain time, and then work towards meeting that challenge. But I also weave for very personal reasons, too. I always keep in mind the instructions given by the flight attendant before takeoff. If the oxygen masks come down, put on yours before you help someone else. You can't help anyone else if you have passed out from lack of oxygen. Weaving is my oxygen. It gives me satisfaction, enjoyment, pleasure, and lower blood pressure. If I don't weave at least a little bit every day, I am not a very happy person. And if I'm not happy, I'm not very nice to be around. So for the sake of my family and friends, I make sure I weave a little bit every day. It's also a lot less expensive than therapy.
What great advice. Thank you, Laura, for phoning that in. We also have a book recommendation from Elizabeth Milner in London.
Hi, Sine. My name is Elizabeth. I just wanted to call in with a book recommendation, a fiction book for young adults that mentions weaving quite a lot, actually. It's by an author named Tamora Pierce, Tamora Pierce. It's called The Magic in the Weaving, and it's one of a set of four in a series called The Circle of Magic. And it's quite good. It's actually what got me interested in weaving in the first place, because I'm not exactly a weaver yet. I think your listeners would really enjoy it, and I bet you would enjoy it too.
Thank you for that recommendation. I'll have to go check it out. Coming up next, Swatch of the Day, in which I'll describe my experiments with woven shibori. Today's Swatch of the Day, I'm going to describe the making of a woven shibori rayon chenille scarf. Woven shibori is one of those things that the first time I saw a woven shibori chenille scarf at a Seattle Weavers Guild sale, I was just like, oh my God, how was that done? That is so beautiful. I must learn how to do that. The scarf that inspired such passion in me was done by Dorothy Day, and she generously shared her information about how to do woven shibori with the guild by doing a free summer workshop. I was a very new mother at the time and wasn't sure I was going to be able to do the workshop. Dorothy actually came to my house when my son was 3 weeks old, and I got a babysitter to watch Kai so that I could focus, but she brought all of the materials to my house. I was just blown away at her generosity, because I live out in the boondocks. It's quite a hike. So thank you, Dorothy. Now, this scarf I've made is the only thing I've ever woven that my husband loves. The underlying chenille was a silvery gray. Then I did the woven shibori technique and overdyed it black. and it was a blue-black. So what happened is you get this wonderfully organic black pattern on top of the silver gray, but because it was a blue-black, there's also some blue shading that happens. It gives it kind of a three-dimensional look. It's really lovely. And when I say blue-black, if you've ever dyed with black, you know that there is no such thing as pure black. All blacks are made out of really intense concentrations of blue or green or purple. So if you dilute them down, you'll see those secondary colors coming out. And sometimes, as in this case, it really works to your advantage. To get into a bit more detail of what happens with woven shibori, in traditional shibori, you take a piece of cloth and you stitch on it. You can do whatever kind of pattern you want. Some people do lines, some do circles, some do intricate leaf shapes. And then you pull those stitches tight. So you're effectively tie-dyeing, but instead of wrapping strings on the outside, you're using the stitches that have been stitched through the cloth to gather it and create a resist. This works beautifully and creates amazing results, but is very time-consuming. Weavers began weaving in these supplemental threads as they're weaving the ground cloth. So in this scarf that I'm describing today, the ground cloth, I wove with 1450 yards per pound rayon chenille. I used a silver gray color both as the warp and as the tabby weft. And by tabby, I just mean the plain weave weft. I warped up 3 yards worth, and it was 8 inches in the reed. And it was set at 16 ends per inch, so 2 ends per dent in an 8-dent reed. And most people who come to rayon chenille for the first time set it too loosely. It looks like a fatter yarn than it actually is. When you're looking at rayon chenille, you have to consider that it's going to act like the thickness of the binder thread, which is pretty darn thin. 16 ends per inch gives a really sumptuous fabric if you're working with 1450 chenille warp and 1450 chenille weft. Every once in a while, like every 8 picks or so, I would weave a supplemental weft of pearl cotton in a monk's belt threading, which is just a very simple block threading that creates checkerboard effect if you do it normally. But in this case, I would do a checkerboard weave and then do another checkerboard. And so if you look up on the blog, there's a picture of the pattern it created. And it's very interesting. It looks like a zebra skin or something, just very organic and beautiful. I'll have the WIF file that shows the threading I used, if you're not familiar with monk's belt, so you can see what that looked like. But it was a very easy technique. It was a 2-shuttle technique, but you weren't using both shuttles continuously. Mostly you wove plain weave. Every once in a while, you would throw in an extra pick of the supplemental weft. When you did that, you would leave these big loops hanging off the end. You didn't want to pull your weft tight. You needed those loops to put your fingers in so you could gather and bunch the fabric up tight. So first you would weave the piece with all the supplemental threads in. You cut it off the loom. You pull those supplemental threads tight to gather the fabric in the middle. And then you tie them so they stay tight because you want it to be rock hard as you possibly can pull it. In fact, Dorothy Day in her workshop recommended putting Band-Aids on your fingers so you could pull really, really tight without hurting yourself. And then once your fabric is all tight, 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 then you over-dye it in the darker color. Or you could throw it into a bleach if you had a dark-colored scarf and you wanted to do a discharge effect. But in this case, I took the silver scarf, pulled it tight, tied the strings tight so it's kind of looked like this really contorted caterpillar. And the dye that Dorothy had was a vat dye. It turned out yummy and beautiful. And the thing is, it's a very simple, easy technique. You could do this on a rigid heddle loom if you had a pickup stick to do the supplemental threads, because it's basically, most of what you're weaving is plain weave. Very simple technique, creates a very complex looking cloth. I just love this technique. It just sends me. It was one of the first things that got me really excited about weaving. So that's my experience doing woven shibori. You can also do a painted warp and then do shibori on top for even a more complicated effect. Or you don't have to weave plain weave. You could weave a twill and do woven shibori. You can take this technique and just run with it. Next up, we have a conversation with Catherine Ellis, who has a book out from Interweave Press called Woven Shibori. And she's going to talk about her experiences with this technique. And then we'll come back from that and talk about her book a bit.
We're here today with Catherine Ellis, who is a wonderful weaver and does very organic and textured weavings. She's worked a lot with a method called woven shibori that we'll be finding out more about. So thank you for being on the show, Catherine, and welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be talking with you today.
Hand weaving is a very unusual profession, so I'm always curious. How did you get started?
My first introduction to hand weaving was in college. Weaving had just been introduced into the college art department. It was something that I picked up on right away because I had been involved in cloth, clothing, and sewing for many, many years.
Now, what were you doing with cloth before you took a weaving course in college?
Well, I was sewing and doing lots of sewing and stitching. I worked all through high school at a fabric store. I learned to sew at a very early age, and I made all of my own clothing. And it never occurred to me that it was possible to back that up one step and actually make the cloth before making the clothing. And it was a pretty amazing discovery to find that out. I think if someone had introduced me to weaving at an earlier age, I would have picked it up very, very quickly.
Are you one of those weavers who was intimidated to cut their hand weaving in the beginning, or was it just really easy for you because you had a sewing background?
It wasn't difficult. I was able to cut into it without any problem. In addition to the background I got in college, I also hooked up with a great bunch of master weavers from the Boston area, which I came from. They were all involved in study groups. They took me under their wing, and they taught me all kinds of technical information. So they really gave me a strong background in order to pursue that.
Was this part of a guild in Boston?
Yes, it was. It was part of the Boston Weavers Guild.
From there, how did you evolve into teaching weaving?
It's kind of interesting. By the time I got through college, I was spending half of my time weaving and half of my time making pots, very serious about being a potter. And when I got through in college, I knew I had to make a decision whether I was going to be a weaver or whether I was going to be a potter. And I was very seriously leaning toward pottery and looking at pottery studios where I could rent space. And then one day a good friend of mine came to me, and she had a great, big, huge floor loom. And she also had a very small baby. And she couldn't spend the time weaving, and she wanted to know if I would take care of that loom for several years.
Well, good thing she gave you the loom and not the baby.
Well, that sort of made up my mind about that. I never made another pot, and I never looked back. Having that loom in my hand sort of defined what it was that I was going to do.
No regrets all these years later?
No, not a single one. It took me a while to find a way to be weaving all the time, and that was my goal from the very beginning, to find a way to do that all the time. And that took a few more years.
So how did you evolve into a full-time weaver?
Several years out of college, I came to North Carolina, and I enrolled in an 8-week concentration class at Penland School of Craft. I was looking for something to help me make that bridge and help me to learn how to be professional at what I love to do. I came to North Carolina, took an 8-week class, and never went back. In Western North Carolina, there is a huge community of full-time artists and craftspeople. It's supportive, and just being in that environment, it helped me find a way to make a living doing what I loved.
When did you discover shibori? And what is shibori?
Shibori is traditionally a type of resist. Shibori is a word that describes what we sort of look at as tie-dye, but the shibori is the Japanese word, which really talks about a whole lot more. It's resist applied to cloth by means of stitches, folding, shaping, twisting, anything that will form a resist or die or any other process that might be applied to that cloth. And the Japanese have done very sophisticated things with it, much more sophisticated than the tie-dye that many of us remember from the 60s and the 70s.
Right, I've seen all kinds of intricate patterns
mm-hmm.
that are very meticulously planned out, but because of the way the dye diffuses, also have an organic quality that's
exactly.
very intriguing.
Exactly. I made the connection between weaving and shibori in the early 90s. I went back to Penland once again as a student, and I took a class with Yoshiko Wada, who wrote the book on shibori. She was talking to us about shibori. We were really learning a lot about Japanese textile history. But I got doing some stitching, just stitching into a piece of silk cloth with a needle and thread, and sort of thinking about that a lot. I wasn't meaning to become a shibori expert or to even learn a whole lot about it, but I did those stitches more as a meditation than anything else. But by then, I had been weaving for many years. When you immerse yourself in something like weaving, which is so structured, and you know it so well, you begin to solve problems like a weaver. You begin to think like a weaver, always looking for other ways of doing things. And as I was making these stitches, it occurred to me that they didn't have to be put into a cloth that was already made. I could put those into the cloth while I was weaving it. It seemed so obvious. It was a natural. Eventually, I got around to trying it. Sometimes, we think about things a whole long time and never get around to trying them. And that almost happened with me. But eventually, several months later, I finally tried it. And I was rather astonished at the result.
What did it look like, your first attempt?
My first attempt was a weaving that was done on a simple monk's belt. I was using monk's belt patterning to put in shibori resist. And it was sort of like the monk's belt, but it was about three steps removed. It was much more organic. It was soft. It was almost like somebody else had done it, which was kind of a thrill to me. Very quickly, I started working with other weave structures. I started working with twills and other things and realized it was an entire vocabulary of patterning that could be applied to the cloth.
What are some weave structures that you really enjoyed doing the woven shibori technique with?
Twills are something that I've worked with extensively. I've worked with lace patterns. Very recently, I've been doing a lot of work with overshot.
Oh.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought overshot.
Well, yes. It fulfills all the requirements for shibori. It gives me a plain woven ground. It gives me floats on top of the cloth, and I can control where the patterns go. It challenged everything I know about woven structure and forced me to take it to other places.
What surprises you most about woven shibori?
I guess the thing that surprises me the most is the fact that there are so many different applications. I started this in the very beginning using indigo as a dye and using woven shibori as a resist for dyeing. But it has evolved to many more things. It's been a resist for application of dye, for removal of dye. It's been a means of shaping cloth. It's been a means of burning cloth out. It just continues to surprise me how I can alter the cloth by means of shibori.
Now, you've actually written a book with Interweave Press called Woven Shibori. How did that come about?
I have been teaching the process of woven shibori for almost 10 years now. In order to facilitate the teaching, I self-published a small monograph because I needed to get it in print. I needed a tool with which to work with students mm-hmm. and to explain this process. And I was conversing with the folks from Interweave and asking about the possibility of doing a real book one day with colored pictures and all of, a lot more information. And it just so happens that they were in a period in their cycle of book publications that my book would fit right into that. We signed a contract. I spent the next year writing, doing more sampling, and we spent another year editing, and there grows the book. It really puts together what I had been doing in Shibori up until that point.
It's a beautiful book.
No,
it's got gorgeous pictures, and if anyone is interested in delving deeper into Woven Shibori than we can go into in this interview, I highly recommend it. I've looked at some of your work that you've done since the Woven Shibori book, and it's all very textural and organic. Mm-hmm. What is it about that design that inspires you?
I live in one of the most beautiful places in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I live in western North Carolina, sort of in the middle of Smoky and Blue Ridge Mountains. It's beautiful here, and I am very much inspired by nature, mm-hmm. by what I see around me, by the ever-changing landscape of these mountains, the colors, the light, the foliage. That is a great inspiration to what I try to do in my cloth. You know, I've spent years trying to capture some of those images in cloth. And Shibori has finally given me a large enough vocabulary in which to layer pattern and layer color. And it's not just a single application of dye. Very often I'll go in and resist and dye a piece of cloth half a dozen times. It starts with what I see, and then it grows in my hands, in the cloth.
Your designs look very pottery-like to me, and now that you mentioned that you're a potter, it all kind of makes sense, because when you do pottery, there's a certain amount of loss of control with respect to how the glazes get put together.
That's an interesting parallel. I never thought about my cloth being like pottery before. I think it's the process that is similar. One of the most exciting things about making pottery is glazing a piece, putting it in the kiln, and giving it up to that process. You close that kiln up, and you learn everything you can about how to fire that kiln correctly, how to use the right glazes. But until the kiln is cooled down and you open the door, you don't know what you've got. Very often, you are surprised, sometimes very pleasantly, and sometimes it's a big disappointment. As a weaver, we're always just so responsible for everything that we see in front of us mm-hmm. on the loom. What you see is what you get. If you don't like it, it's your responsibility. You know, and sometimes we don't like it, and we unweave, and we put in again. When you've woven for as long as I have, sometimes you get tired of what you see right in front of you. You'd like to be surprised. What the Shibori has brought to my own weaving is that element of the unknown, where I weave a piece of cloth with every bit of information I have. I gather it up, I dye it, I submit it to all kinds of processes, and then finally I take out those gathering threads, and the end result is revealed to me. And that's what I mean by when I say that in the beginning it almost felt like somebody else had their hand in it. Because I wasn't in control of all of it. And it feels very good to be giving up some of that control, to let something happen that isn't all about what I'm doing to the cloth.
You've done some very interesting work recently combining wool and stainless steel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain a little bit about the inspiration behind that?
Sometimes my fabrics are... Their starting point is a visual image that I'm working with. And a lot of the more organic, nature-oriented pieces are like that. But sometimes what gets me started is material. And I enjoy working with new materials and getting to know their nature. Very recently, we've had a lot of very interesting materials appear in the marketplace. Wool and steel combinations, cotton and steel combinations, silk and steel, bamboo and copper.
Are these wires that have fibers around them, or are they more mixed together than that?
They're usually two different elements that have been lightly twisted together.
Oh, so a ply then?
It's a ply, but the steel is a very flexible steel fiber. It's not a wire. It's really a flexible fiber. So when I look at a fiber like that, yeah, it's cool. It's interesting. And the temptation is just to weave what I've always woven, just using a new material. But I always challenge myself to look a little bit deeper than that and say, what is the nature of this material and how can I take advantage of its characteristics. So it sort of puts me in mind of Annie Albers back in the 40s, you know, discovering new material and really exploring the nature of those and what they do. So when I have a yarn that all stainless steel, for instance, and I want to apply woven shibori to that, well, I can weave the cloth with all stainless steel, and I can gather it, but I can't dye it. But what can I do? Fabric like that, which is all stainless steel, I've actually taken a torch to. I can change the color with a torch. I can change the texture with a torch. I can explore the characteristics of that yarn. Also, been using yarn that's a combination of wool and stainless. I've been using a chemical burn to burn out some of the wool, exposing the stainless steel, so that there are areas that are very transparent and areas that are very opaque. Let's call it a woven shibori lace, not a woven lace structure. It's a woven shibori with areas that are transparent and areas that are opaque.
Now, what is the hand of this fabric that has the metal in it? Is it soft? Is it drapeable? Is it
Yes, it is soft and drapeable.
Really?
It's got a little bit of body and stiffness because of the metal content in it.
Very interesting. I would have thought it would just stand up by itself.
No, it doesn't, because the steel is so fine. The steel is very, very fine. It's not a wire. It's a flexible fiber.
And is it made up of multiple fibers or just
multiple very fine filaments of steel? This is yarn that was engineered in Japan. It's very specialized.
So you've been a weaving instructor at Haywood Community College for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
What have you learned from that experience?
At Haywood Community College, I teach a full-time professional craft program. So I have students who have dedicated 2 years of their life to come and learn about weaving and learn about the business of weaving and learn how to become weavers themselves. The level of student that I have is always really high. Not necessarily that they come with a lot of skills, but they come with a serious intent. They are really, really dedicated. I think one of the most important things I have learned from that is that I need to stay challenged to keep them challenged. I need to keep learning things. I guess one of the other things that I've learned over the years, that it's not the amount of technical information that they have, but it's what they do with it and how they learn to focus it and how they learn to bring themselves into their textile work. That's the most important thing for them.
Are you training people to be weavers who are artists or weavers that go into industry?
No, we're not training people to work in industry. We're really training people who are going to work in their own studios, as artists, craftsmen, small studio production. Some of our students graduate, do functional work. Some of them do non-functional work, and their work really spans everything from high-volume production to one-of-a-kind pieces. They also learn the business and marketing of running a craft business.
Sounds like a very complete program.
Yes, it is.
There are very few opportunities I've heard about to get all of that in one curriculum.
Well, it's a very unusual program, and over the years we've had the freedom to teach what we thought was important. It's really been a wonderful place to teach all of these years.
Yeah, it makes me want to move to North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Many people do. There are a number of people who have moved to North Carolina to go to school there.
With all this experience teaching people and helping people learn weaving, what advice would you give to someone just starting out?
First of all, I'd advise somebody to find a teacher or a mentor, if they could. Then I would tell them to get a good foundation, a good basic background, to work really, really hard, and then don't be afraid to specialize in something, to get to know something really, really well. I mean, none of us can do everything really well.
Right.
And once you have a background, It is so much more satisfying to learn how to do something really, really well. And I think a lot of times people are afraid to make that commitment. At the college, I force students for the first year to learn a little bit of everything. And then in the second year, they're really required to specialize.
I've heard that advice over and over again as I talk to weavers.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be key. Because like you say, you can't know everything.
No, you can't. And if you think you do, then you could spend years and years collecting little bits of information and never doing something that's really your own. And I think that's important to bring yourself into your work somehow.
What's next for you? What's your next challenge you've got planned for yourself?
The immediate challenge is next week I am going to Brussels, Belgium, to attend the opening of the International Lace Biennial, in which I have a piece of this wool and steel fabric. That's the immediate future. After that, I think I'm just going to keep going. I'm really not sure. This whole concept of lace and transparency has intrigued me right now. I know I will be influenced by what I see next week in Brussels. I have begun some combinations of cellulose and polyester fabrics and exploring the idea of lace through that. I think I'm almost ready to jump into jacquard woven shibori. That little bit further in the future.
That sounds really cool. It'd be like the intricate stitching that they do in Japan with pictures that they shibori, but with jacquard.
Right. I'm going to keep learning, and I'm not quite sure what... I don't think I ever know what I'm going to learn next. It's a matter of paying attention and responding to something as it presents itself.
I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to come chat with us. Can't wait to see what you do next.
You're very welcome. It was really a treat to do this.
That was Catherine Ellis. Thank you for being on the show and talking to us about woven shibori. Next up, we've got a review of her book. Now, a review of the book Woven Shibori by Catherine Ellis. This is an Interweave Press publication. It's one of their The Weaver Studio series. It is an exhaustive discussion of woven shibori. When I picked up this book, I was kind of like, well, I've done woven shibori. I pretty much know what's going on. I don't think there's going to be a lot this book can teach me. Boy, was I wrong. Catherine Ellis goes into this subject with such depth. She has tried things with woven shibori that I couldn't even imagine. She starts off talking about traditional stitch shibori and the history of shibori in Japan, where it originated. Then she goes in over the basic procedure, how to weave it, the tying it up and pleating it, the dyeing. In the section where she talks about weaving the shibori, I had learned monk's belt. Shafts 1 and 2 weave together, shafts 3 and 4 weave together, and you make kind of a checkerboard. Anyway, she talks about monk's belt. She has pictures that illustrate each step of the process. She talks about using many, many different weave structures with woven shibori. Overshot, twills, laces, summer and winter. Pretty much any kind of weave you could think of, this woman has applied to woven shibori. And she even talks about pickup shibori, where you can just freeform pick up warp threads as you're weaving to place the supplemental gathering weft wherever you want. I thought this was really interesting because this means that you could do woven shibori on any loom, even a really simple two-shaft loom, like a rigid heddle loom, or a backstrap loom, if you're willing to pick up threads to put in the supplemental warps, and you only have to do that every ninth pick, every tenth pick, because the rest of it is just plain weave with your main weft. The end of the book, she starts talking about advanced techniques like mixing fibers, using polyester either in the weft or the warp, to make fabrics that are permanently pleated because polyester heat sets. So if your weft is polyester and your warp is silk, I know that sounds wrong, but just stick with me here for a second. And then you pleat the shibori and steam it, that polyester will remold itself to the crimpled form. And so when you take the supplemental wefts out and unfold the cloth, it'll retain that pleated nature. In fact, in the book, there was a really cool dress that was a tube of this pleated fabric. It was very form-fitting and beautiful and just very elegant. It hadn't even been dyed. It just used the shibori as shaping. Very interesting technique. She also talks about using multiple dye baths, layering color upon color, using discharge to remove color in places, devore, chemically burning away some of the fiber. She's done work with stainless steel threads. Just really interesting, wild, out there stuff that I would never have considered doing. The book is an inspiration. The one slight dissatisfaction with the book, it is so packed with knowledge that it's a dense book. It's not a book you can just sit down and read cover to cover in an evening. It's a book that works very well as a reference book, as an inspiration book. But I found that I had to kind of read a bunch and then think and digest before I could read the next chapter. But I was delighted with it. Another wonderful thing that Catherine Ellis did in the book is she highlighted the work of many artists. There are some gorgeous jackets in there by Candace Cole. And of course, being an Interweave Press book, it is rich with beautiful graphics, nicely drawn, clear line drawings to illustrate steps, gorgeous pictures. Catherine Ellis also talks about Kay Faulkner's work. Now, Kay Faulkner is a weaver in Australia, and apparently she started developing woven shibori and playing with that at around the same time that Catherine Ellis was playing with it. It was wonderful to be able to see how the two artists had taken the same technique and run with it in slightly different directions. Because each weaver who tries a technique brings their own interests and biases and ingenuity to it. In addition to Candace Cole and Kay Faulkner, there were other artists sprinkled through. And so there's just a lot of rich, beautiful photographs of woven shibori fabric. Tons of information. If you're interested in woven shibori, this book has all you need to know to get started, plus enough to get you thinking and being inspired for years. I'm really delighted that Catherine sat down and wrote this book so that I could have it in my house. And now it's time for today's audio essay, Weavecast, 2006 Year-End Report. Now, this isn't going to be one of those dry recitations of numbers and bar charts. If you want all that, it is available up on the website, and it's actually kind of interesting. I have some text to spice it up, and I talk about how the show's going. If you want to see the official Weavecast Year-End Report, if, say, you're a donating listener and you've wondered how your money has been spent, or you're a sponsor and you want to know how the show is doing in terms of listenership, please go check out all of that on the website. It'll be a link on the show notes to the Year-End Report 2006. And it's really kind of interesting. This is the first time I've ever been involved in a broadcast venture, so it was very enlightening to put all the figures together and see how things are going. Listenership has grown tremendously. From our beginnings last February with no listeners, our most recent show downloaded 2,273 times. So that shows that thousands of people on the internet have discovered the show. And I think that's wonderful. And I would really like to express my gratitude to all of the listeners, because without you, there'd be no show. I'd just be a woman with a microphone. So thank you for tuning in and listening, and thank you for telling your friends about the show. As listenership has grown, people are going back and downloading all the previous shows. So if you go look at the chart on the internet, you'll see that there's this sharp curve as listenership is growing, but then there's a second curve that shows how even older shows are getting lots of play as new people come on board. Next up, we have the financials. Now, we have been very fortunate in that WeaveCast listeners are a generous bunch and have sent in $638 in donations. Thank you. I am just blown away. With sponsorships and CD sales, the total income of WeaveCast was almost $1,000. The bad news, unfortunately, is that because this was the first year of WeaveCast, there were a lot of startup expenses. I spent over $1,000 in audio equipment and another couple of hundred dollars in software. Our net is an operating loss of $1,500. And it was kind of weird to see that on the sheet. On one hand, it was like, woohoo, I only lost $1,500. And on the other hand, it was, whoa. Those of you who are donating listeners, please feel free at this moment to go get a cup of tea and maybe sit down and weave a little bit and feel completely smug. Those of you who are listeners who have not yet found time to donate, let me just put a few things in perspective. Our operating loss means that my family has been donating $125 a month to WeaveCast. Now, I'm not asking you to match that. But if you enjoy the show, please consider sending in a donation. If you simply forgo one latte a month, if sitting down and listening to an hour of WeaveCast gives you as much charge as a double Frappuccino, please consider sending that money to WeaveCast, because $3.50 a month, $42 a year, would go a long way towards helping make this podcast break even. And if you can't send in that much, please send in whatever is comfortable for you. No donation is too small. Think about it. If everyone who had listened to the Anita Luvera Mayer episode had put $1 in an envelope, we would have broken even this year. So please, if you haven't had time to donate yet, consider helping us out. I'm having a lot of fun doing the show. I want to keep doing it. I've committed to doing it through 2007, but I could sure use your help. Now, speaking of people who have been helping the show, I finally got our anonymous transcriber to allow me to publicly thank her. There are many transcripts up on the website for the hearing impaired and those with dial-up connections who can't manage the 50 megabyte downloads. Those transcripts have been provided by Laura Fry. She has donated hours to generating these transcripts. Some of them are 23 pages long. She's been using substandard equipment, and unfortunately, the AV connection on the equipment she was using has broken, and so we're now trying to figure out if we can afford to purchase her transcription equipment. If you have friends who have been using the transcripts, please consider making a donation to help support that effort. We will figure something out, I'm confident, but your help would be very appreciated. And Laura, I can't believe that with all that you do, supporting yourself with your weaving, mentoring countless weavers through online email lists, that you have also found time to dedicate towards transcribing WeaveCast episodes. You just simply amaze me, woman, and thank you. And there's another group of unsung heroes who have been instrumental in WeaveCast's success and growth. This is the podcast community. Other podcasters have been incredibly generous with technical advice, creative advice, and support for those times when the software blows up and takes away 6 hours of editing. Thank you. Thank you, guys. To celebrate WeaveCast's first year anniversary, several of them sent me amusing audio clips. So let's take a listen to some of those now.
Hey, Hey there, Sign Mitchell. This is Brenda Dane from Cast On. Congratulations on your 1 year podcasting anniversary. Putting out a podcast for an entire year is no mean feat, and I am very glad that you are still here, still podcasting, and still warped enough to weave.
Hey, Weavecast listeners, this is Faith from the Knitting Cook podcast. Sign, I hold you personally responsible for the fact that for some reason now, I feel like I need to buy a loom. I had never even considered this a year ago. Because of all of your fabulous interviews that you have with these great guests and the way that you put your show together, you are definitely tempting me over to the warped side. Congratulations on your very first podcast anniversary.
Happy birthday, Weavecast.
What's your name?
Kai. Kai Matron Island.
G'day, Sign. It's David Reedy from Sticks and String in the beautiful Blue Mountains to the west of Sydney, wishing you all the best for your 1 year anniversary with Weavecast. Congratulations on 1 year, and I look forward to listening to many more shows over the coming year. If anyone can convince me to go out and buy a loom, it's you.
She's a writer. She's a weaver. She builds decks by herself. And now she's celebrating a year in podcasting. Sign. 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 If she weren't so fabulous, I'd hate her.
Aren't they wonderful? It just amazes me how many talented people there are doing podcasts these days. Links to all of their shows will be available on the show notes. And now you may be wondering, what does the future hold for Weavecast? Well, we're going to keep bringing you all the wonderful weaving content that you've come to enjoy. I'm considering starting a video podcast, just occasional video snippets of a particular weaving technique. I've been looking at a knitting podcast called Let's Knit Together, which is a video podcast. And some things would just be best presented in a video format. I may pull out the video camera that we bought when Kai was born and see if I can figure out video editing. Thank you to everyone who's made the first year of Weavecast such a success. I really could not have done this without you. Thank you also to my husband and son, who have put up with endless hours of audio editing and lots of hours on the road traveling to interviews. That's all for this episode. It's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. I'm going to play you out with a fun song to celebrate 1 year of Weavecast. This is Happy Birthday by Cramo.
Been saying here. Time to give yourself a cheer. Even if it's not today, I wish you much fun anyway.
When I say happy, you say birthday. Happy.
Birthday.
Happy.
Birthday.
When I say happy, you say birthday. Happy.
Birthday.
Happy.
Birthday.
Happy, happy love.
Happy love.
Would like to thank its generous donating listeners. Since last episode, Gina, Kaz, Harriet, and Marlene have all sent in donations. Thank you so much for investing in the show. In addition, gratitude goes out to the wonderful artists who share their musical talents on the PodSafe Music Network. This episode, we played Happy Birthday by Cramo, and our ambient music was Osaka Caravan, Japanese Greenhouse by Ben Reed. I wanted something with a Japanese feel to honor the origins of Shibori.